Colleagues, good morning. I'd like to call to order this meeting for February 28th, 2017 of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education. And we are ready to reopen or continue. Do I bang again for reopen?
Yes.
Okay. We are ready to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 5038, the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission budget bill. So I would like to invite Dr. Bean to return to the table, as well as Lisa Pearson from DAS.
Is it the 23rd? Yesterday, so it would be the 27th.
Good morning. Co-Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Monica Bean. I'm the Executive Director of the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. And I also have beside me Trent Donowski, who is the Deputy Director.
For reference sake, it will be page 27, or 37. Excuse me, you're starting out.
That's exactly what I was just going to say. Right. So we're starting with slide 37, which is one slide beyond halfway through the presentation, so that's a good sign. So we're going to start with professional practices, which is the investigations or the discipline summary. So chapter 342 of the ORS requires that the commission suspend or revoke license or registration of any teacher or administrator, discipline a teacher or administrator, or suspend or revoke the right of any person to apply for a license or registration under prescribed circumstances. And we take that very seriously. So we are also required, which is very unusual in comparison to other states in the country, Oregon is required to investigate all complaints or information received from educators or the public regarding possible licensed educator misconduct. That public portion is the part that's very unique to this state. And since 2000, just as a point of reference, there has been a steady increase in the number of patron complaints coming from the public. There were 20 in 2000, and in just 2016 there were 121, so a pretty significant increase. The people that we serve, first and foremost, are the students, because they want to make sure that the students are in fact safe, and then of course the general public, investigated educators, and then the remainder of the educators in the system. There are two different types of, there are many different types of discipline actions. And so I know that one of our key performance measures is to have the number of investigations that are completed within that basically 180 days. And I'm very pleased to announce that we have cut that number in half. What you're looking at on this slide is that the average investigations for charges of misconduct, that means that that has resulted in an action from the commission. Again, the average investigation length is 12 months. That's from the date that we receive the complaint to the completion of the investigation, knowing that our commission meets quarterly. So again, that's the average length. That is not the typical length. And then for investigations resulting in commission dismissal, the investigation length is approximately 12.1 months from the date of the complaint to completion of the investigation. And for the first time since 2012, our lowest number of pending investigations is 188, which is significantly lower than where it was even in June of 2016. We've cut that number by 50 cases in 6 months, which is huge progress. The trends in disciplines is something that we thought might be of interest to you as committee members, that why are all these complaints coming to TSPC? And three of the top trends that our team of investigators have found is boundary issues. And we contribute that to many different factors, one being that there are very few school counselors in our schools. So teachers and principals tend to assume the role of a counselor. And so that boundary issue of how far is too far before they've gone beyond the role of the teacher and more of a friend situation. And so those are most of the issues that are sent to the agency. Social media, huge, huge influx of social media cases. What may seem as an innocent text message to check on someone, a student, to see how they're doing, or say, hey, great job on whatever test, sometimes that's taken out of context, and so we have to make sure that we educate educators and pre-service educators so that they're not set up for potential issues with social media. And then the third largest is improper restraint, and that's for our special education population. So we have special educators who deal with very, very, very significant issues with students, from emotional to behavior to their physical restraint are there are guidelines that must be followed. But sometimes when some student who may be 16 years old swings at you, the natural instinct may be to protect yourself. And so there's a huge need for professional development in that area with regard to improper restraint.
Representative.
Thank you. So you mentioned in an earlier slide about the growing number of complaints coming from parents, I assume, or citizens. Mm-hmm. But help me, so this talks about boundaries, social media, and proper strain. I'm trying to understand, so where do, in those cases, so where do the majority of them, how do they get referred to you, or where do they come from? Since I understand some are coming from parents, but the majority are coming from, are they coming from their administrator, they're coming from other teachers, or?
Co-Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Lively, thank you for your question. So there is a mixture for those particular, so social media and boundaries, those are really, most of them that result in action come from the district. So they are founded, there's already been an investigation at the district level, it's then forwarded on to us, to our separate investigation, and that results in a some sort of a disciplinary action. Many of the patron complaints result in no further action or dismissal. So those are typically less severe cases. And so just to make sure, would something fall through the cracks? Very, very, very slim chance of that, because the chances are if they have reported it to us, they have reported it to the district as well.
So I could ask one more. Follow Thank up? You. So you talked about the 12 months. So in the case of action that has the district has thoroughly investigated in that and forwarded on their results, does it still take 12 months from that point forward?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Lively, thank you for the question. It really depends. It depends on the situation. It could be the availability of the teacher, the availability of the witnesses, the availability of the principal involved. So it really depends. It's so situational that it's difficult to say that one case is going to take the exact same amount of time as another case.
Maybe another thing that might be helpful, particularly to show how there's a couple long cases that often listen, is maybe if you could get us some information maybe about the median, you know, length of an investigation, just maybe a couple other ways to look at it, or a range of this many take 1 month or fewer. If you could maybe give us that information in another way, that would probably be helpful.
Sure.
Thank you. Senator Monroe.
I remember when I was a young teacher of AP classes, and one of my students, female, came in after school, closed the door. I got up, opened the door, and then she said, "Mr. Monroe," she says, "I know that you're a Christian, and I need some help." She says, "I'm pregnant, and my parents just kicked me out of the house, and my church just kicked me out of the church. Can you get me help?" I went to the school counselor. In those days, we had school counselors full time. I went to the school counselor. School counselor found her a home to live in, somebody that was willing to take her in. This was in the fall. She finished the school year, got straight A's. By the time she graduated in June, she was very pregnant. She ended up giving the baby up. But the boundary question is a really difficult one, because often teachers are viewed by some of their students as a counselor, as somebody that they can go to for help. And So I tried to provide this young lady with some help, and it ended up pretty well. I mean, she gave up the baby for adoption, and she got straight A's, and she graduated. But where do you draw that boundary? That's always a troubling question. If you're sensitive to the young people that you're trying to teach, and you want to help them when they have problems, and yet it's not really your role as a teacher, it's something else.
Is that a rhetorical question?
I just wondered if, you know...
Hope so.
What do you say to teachers that are thrust into a situation like that?
Co-Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, thank you for the question, the rhetorical and the after part. That is why it is very important that we maintain the staffing that we have so that we can do the outreach that we need to do in conjunction with the higher education educator preparation program, so that we start very early in their preparation program so they know this is the expectation. Here are the resources that are available to you. And then those in-service teachers to say you're not alone, even though there may be a small number of, maybe even not a counselor in your building, there are other resources available. And here's how you get to that that resource, the most appropriate venue for that. It is a delicate and a very thin line.
Thank you. Go ahead.
So the next slide you're looking at are the actual reports of misconduct, and I do apologize. There seems to be a numerical error, so I know that Senator Monroe would point this out if he looked at it very carefully. It does start with zero, but if you look at the last column, the number doesn't add up, so we're not sure how that happened. But the total number of cases in 2016 is 249, not 231. And then again, there were... So in 2016, we received 231 cases. Of those cases, 128 were from the schools, and then 121 were from patrons. So 249 total, about half of those coming from the patron side of things. So that's why it's really important to maintain the staffing that we have. So again, the dark blue bar is the school, the light blue bar is the patron, and then the total case number at the top is accurate except for 2016. So you can see there's a steadily increase in number of cases. The next slide is the new and complete investigations. Again, for the first time since 2010, our agency is completing more investigations than we are receiving in that particular year. So 231 investigation complaints received, 262 investigations completed. So we're working on that backlog very, very diligently and making progress. The next slide is the outcome of those cases. If you'll notice that of the 329 cases that were considered in 2016, 4 resulted in a reinstatement or denial. 73 resulted in no further action. That means that the district has already taken action. 121 resulted in dismissal of charges. So of the 329 cases, 121 plus the 73, no action. But they were investigated just as thoroughly as the remaining cases. 24 resulted in letters of approval, 54 charged, and then 53 actions. So again, over half of the cases resulted in no further action for our agency. We're going to move into our key performance measures. So as you know, we have 4 key performance measures that determine our effectiveness as an agency. The phone and email customer service, the percent of phone calls and emails responded to within 3 days. We break that down into calls and emails. The percentage of calls that were answered, as in not dropped, was 60.9% in 2014. So a little over half of the calls we received, we were able to answer and accommodate the questions. That increased by 26% to 86.3% in 2016, even though the volume of calls increased significantly as well. And again, that was due to having three full-time and 2 limited duration positions to actually answer those calls. The email changed from 20 weeks, In August of 2016, we had 6,055 calls, 1 month. This summer, this August, we had 6,055 calls. Our answer rate was 64.5%, and we only had about 4 regular employees there because of the rotation. We had a change in staff, and we were still able to maintain a higher percentage than 2014. January 2017, 3,079 calls received, and our answer rate was 86.3%. So we're really having a steadily increasing trend in customer service. Our number of applications processing, looking at key performance measure number two, percent of completed applications processed in 20 days. While that percentage is barely showing a growth because we're tending to focus more on the backlog of getting that week's process date up, I would like to say that in 2014, we were processing applications and issuing licenses 20 weeks behind, 20 weeks. When I started in June, we were at 12 weeks. In February, we are less than 6 weeks. In fact, from time to time, we're less than 4 weeks. It depends on the volume of applications that come in. And by the volume of applications that come in, I'd like to say, I was looking at the numbers after I left yesterday, and we had, from January 10th was the oldest date of our application that we could process that's not a legal investigation, so January 10th. Since January 10th, through January 10th to yesterday, we received 2,847 applications. So around 3,000 applications that came in that are not under legal review. We have more, but some of those are under legal review, so my evaluators cannot touch those. That means that they would need to process 151 applications per day in order to just get the same number out as what we bring in. They're averaging much higher than 151 per day. In fact, when you round the numbers up, it actually is more—it's more closely to 200 applications per day. There are days where it's almost 300 applications that are issued, and there are days because of people not being there and vacation and other things, other factors that are not within our control, that maybe it's 150. But they are increasing the number of applications that are processed. So, while the 20-day limit is a key performance measure, I'd like to focus more on the time limit because we could very easily manipulate that number. I could have my staff focus on, all right, issue all of the licenses for all the applications that came in today. That way we can really increase that percentage and we can have 100% of the applications processed. But that's not what's fair to the applicants. It should be processed in the order in which it was received, and that's the right thing to do. So although our KPM is about the percentage within 20 days, we're trying to get it focused to where it's number of time, the oldest application, and then we will get to that 20-day point. Our oldest email, as I've said multiple times, when it came in, it was quite old, over 20 weeks. We moved that to make progress in the summer. Now we're at 7 days. We're less than a week on email, and actually 2 or 3 days at times. It depends on the volume that comes in and who is there in the building that day. Some days we get, 300 emails in. So it may take us a couple of days to answer those because we're also answering phones. But the point is, we're making progress. Customer service is certainly a priority. Well, first, student safety is a priority. And then customer service is certainly something we take very seriously. Next slide. Okay. Next slide. In 2015-16, we issued 1,300 more licenses than we did in 2014-15, so the volume is certainly increasing. And again, some of the results of the agency increase in the fee application has helped that tremendously, so I thank the legislature for that. Okay. Major changes in the last 10 years. Well, a lot has happened in the last 10 years, and we've only been here for 8 months. So from 2002 to 2016, the agency has been very heavily involved with streamlining the application process, from moving from a paper-based system where people sent in cash and checks, which took a very lengthy amount of time to process that, to now to an electronic and digital licensing filing system. We have fluctuated over the years from 3 licensure evaluation staff, those people who actually look at the applications and issue the licenses, to currently we have 4.5. The reason we have the 0.5 is that 0.5 is spent, that individual also works with our commission. So she arranges the meetings. We have commission meetings that occur quarterly and then more frequently with the committees of that commission. So that is her role with the commission as well. The program approval has moved from a checkoff compliance-based system to really looking at the quality of the preparation programs, requiring a national accreditation for all of our institutions with educator prep programs, and also the educator performance assessment that's been implemented. Senate Bill 78 in 2015 required us to establish approval standards for the educator prep programs using those four very, very important criteria. And then also our professional practices and discipline has moved from one investigator in 2002 to three full-time investigators, one limited duration position, which we would really like to maintain, and then also a legal liaison who works directly with the DOJ, the Department of Justice, so that lowers our bill to the DOJ quite extensively, actually, even though they do have increased volume of referrals, so we have had to utilize them quite a bit in the last year. Our revenue, as you know, and I cannot stress this enough, we are an other funds agency. So as you're seeking and striving to balance the general funds budget, we are not adding to any of that for you. We actually are totally funded by the application fees. Again, we had the increase in the last session, so I'm very, very appreciative of that. And we basically have been coming out of the Great Recession impact on the agency, where the budget was lower because of the impact of the districts not hiring and the reduction in force. Therefore, there were not as many people renewing their licenses and applying for application for licenses.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wilson, could you provide the committee what years, you know, what was the ending balance or whatever in all these sweeps? Was it one budget or two budgets, and what kind of money? I thought, you know, the only time we really swept was 2007, wasn't it? Is that when we did the big sweep, or nine?
I think there's been a more, Madam Chair, Representative Wisner, I think there was a more recent one. It was before my time.
Yeah. I'd be interested in knowing what, you know, how much ending balance it was. Did they take it all? Did we take it all? did we take it all? How much we left? And going back 10 years or whatever, that was fine. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair.
Co-Chair Monroe.
Yeah. Teachers getting their first license, it's 3 years, right?
That is correct. If they're coming from an in-state Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Senator Monroe, that is correct. Unless they're coming from an out-of-state situation where they do not hold a full license, and then it would be a 1 year. So they could have completed a program in Idaho but didn't get an Idaho license. So they would get a 1 year, and that would allow them to meet our criteria.
Yeah, and the three-year corresponds to what we used to call tenure, reaching tenure. When I was a teacher anyway, after 3 years, you got tenure. And so then you apply for a second one after you get to your tenure point. Then it's 5 years, and thereafter it's always 5 years.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, that is correct.
Okay.
So the online application system, over the past biennium, the agency received approval to move forward with the online process with the NIC USA, the e-government contractor for the state of Oregon. We ran into a few glitches along the way and are working through those. The most important piece is that all of our applicants can pay and apply online. So that part has been very much streamlined. The part that impacts our agency is that while the applicants are seeing the benefits of paying and applying online, we're still working and operating out of two systems, our legacy system. So we're working through those opportunities. I was going to say obstacles, but they're opportunities. So until we are fully operational with that system, we still have people who have to open the mail and do some scanning of documents and uploading that manually. Proposed legislation. While the agency did not, we did not propose any legislative concepts for this 2017 session. We are tracking very closely a few bills and providing fiscal impact statements as well. And I'd like to highlight just a few bills that we're tracking very closely. Senate Bill 578 directs TSPC to conduct a study regarding the impact of National Board Certification. And so we would obviously work with our partners to do that study because we would not have the internal capacity to do so. But we've already, if that is successfully passed, then we've already networked with someone to help us do that. Senate Bill 2005 was a committee bill that would allow the extension of 90 days. So a person who applied in our online system and passed their background investigation, so they were not doing any harm to students, could go into a classroom for up to 90 days while we process their license. Therefore, they would not need to request the expedited application fee because we're processing and issuing licenses within that 90-day period, actually much quicker than that. So that would be very helpful as well. And then Senate Bill 182, which is the Council on Educator Advancement, that impacts our agency. We were very much a part of that. Our commissioners served on that council, and the recommendations are the governor's recommendations to the governor. She has accepted those, and we are 100% in support of that. Senate Bill 13 is the Native American curriculum. And we are very closely working with the tribes through the government-to-government education sector. And so we're really tracking that bill as well and seeing what our role is. And then House Bill 2763, the National Board, the Accomplished Teaching Fund, Incentive Fund. So that's something we're providing information on as well. The 10% reductions activity, which is not a very positive thing to look at, because if I had to reduce the budget by 10%, it would just be detrimental to all of the growth that the agency has seen in the past few months. So we would start with eliminating the services and supplies, which would be the proposed 2.5 FTE. And of the 2.5 FTE, we would eliminate the halftime operations and policy analyst position. This is a person who does all of our rules. She works the Rules Advisory Committee, which is a new layer of transparency that the agency has implemented to get feedback from the public. We would have to eliminate the 1.0 FTE for the compliance specialist. That is my one FTE that I have for higher education program approval. And then I, as the director, would have to assume that full role, which would be detrimental to those 19 institutions because I know I could not provide the quality of service and support that would be necessary.
Madam Co-Chair.
Co-Chair Monroe.
I'd say since you're an other-funded agency and since we've been harassing that agency to do more, not do less, I don't think you have to worry a whole bunch about your 10% cuts. Every agency has to do that, but being underfunded and with the kind of demands that the legislature and educators have been putting on TSPC over the time, I wouldn't worry too much about it.
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith Warner.
Can you put that in writing?
That was my question.
I'd be happy to.
Thank you for that. And yeah. That. But do you want me to continue with this portion or move forward in the sake of time?
I don't know. It's not critical.
Why don't you just kind of read through the rest of it?
Okay, and the last one would be to eliminate the 1.0 investigator 3 position, which is the position that works with the Department of Justice to really work on the orders, which is a cost savings to the agency. So 10% of our budget would be $643,000, and that's how I would unfortunately have to do that.
And that's over my dead body.
Moving on to the budget environment and then to revenue. So again, we are an other funds agency that is funded solely by our licensure application fees. Again, during the Great Recession and its aftermath, we had both its ending balance swept and endured a budget reduction due to a decrease in the volume of licensing applications submitted to the agency. In 2015, House Bill 2411 resulted in the fee being increased from $100 to $140 for that 3 or 5 year license. So you can see our revenue trend on the next slide.
What did your license cost?
And again, this was submitted in June, and so this was the governor's budget. So we don't have our total ending balance, so that is still estimated for this year, but we are actually predicting to have an increased revenue stream because of the number of applications that we've received in the last biennium being increased significantly. We really anticipate that being increased as well. Those are just our projections.
Thank you. Do you know about how many months that, just that estimated ending balance, what would that be? Because that's something we talk about here, is how many months is, or would your ending balance be? How many months of your budget? Like, is it a, is it 2 months? Is it 6 months?
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, thank you for the question. So my understanding is that we have the three-month contingency, but then we also have additional funds that are, that's in our ending balance, because we had requested an increase in limitations during the December e-board, and we did not request all of the amount of money that was available in our account. We only requested what we needed to maintain what the budget was presented and approved by the legislature last year. And I will defer to Lisa to answer that correctly if I misspoke.
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, my name is Lisa Pearson with the Department of Administrative Services. The governor's budget uses some of that ending balance that Dr. Bean just mentioned. And so the policy packages that she'll be discussing in a moment would, in fact, just leave enough for about 3 to 4 months of operations.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, just another note. Keep in mind, ending balances, you have to take another factor in mind, and that is increasing costs over time. If you use a lot of it and drive it even down to 2 or 3 months, you take the risk of cost increasing on your base budget and having the agency have to come back and get fee increases more than you probably want them to. So you have to factor that into it, too, both in terms of that ugly word of sweeping and also in terms of approving policy packages that will drive that ending balance down over time.
Thank you.
Yeah. Sure. Madam Co-Chair.
Oh, Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah, just to add on to that, in past times when the economy was in trouble and we were fighting for every dime for budgets, we have done what we call sweeping. So one reason that we watch your budget very carefully is we want you to have enough to function for a few months if there's a downturn. On the other hand, we don't want you to have too much, or the big co-chairs and the presiding officers might decide to sweep it. So we're trying to protect your budget by keeping it in that, in that fine-tuned picture.
Thank you. So moving on to the revenue factors that have, oh, let me go back a slide, sorry.
Oh, IT letter.
Go back a, gosh. I think I skipped past the revenue
60.
Forecast summary.
Page
yeah,
60.
Page 60, please. There we go. So I want to make sure you did have a chance to see that. So again, our beginning balance for 17-19 is the $1.698 million. The revenue estimate for 17-19 is $7.2 million, which would be our total available resources of $8.9 million. And the governor's budget for 17-19 would be $8.12 with the estimated ending balance of $754,000. So that would be roughly the little over three-month
yep.
contingency.
That's good.
Okay. So some of the factors that have impacted our revenue increase, because we did have a 23% increase in the number of out-of-state applications just in the last, since July 2015 through June of 2016. So that was a pretty significant increase of people coming from out-of-state. Mine is not in there yet, nor is Mr. Donowski's, but those that will add to it as well. And then we also had an 8.7 increase in the number of applications received overall in the agency. So we're starting to see people apply for licensure, which is really a positive sign in the state. So it's showing some growth. Also, one of the things that impacted it was the substitute teacher shortage. So when you have a substitute teacher shortage, you need more people in classrooms, and that increased the volume of licensure applications overall.
Representative Wisden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, the substitute shortage, did your agency look into the fact there was a, on the paid sick leave, the substitute teacher is designated to fill a requirement, substitute teacher gets sick, so in that situation, you're actually paying three people for one job, and that was creating a significant impact on school budgets, I understand. Did your agency get involved in that at all?
Co-Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Wisnett. I cannot speak to that. I can certainly find out whether we did, but keep in mind that our license, our agency is a licensing board. Yeah. We are not employment, so that would probably be under the purview of the Department of Education, where the general fund is located, as opposed to our board, where it's just the licensure piece. It's a very, it's a line that's very hard to see and hard to separate, that where the licensing part ends and the actual employment part begins. So it's a great question, and I understand where that, but I would have to see whether we had any, it was prior to my tenure.
Thank you, ma'am.
And then also, just a point of reference, the fingerprint fee, which I mentioned, I believe, yesterday, the fingerprint volume increased significantly based on the number of applications that we receive. So as a result, that flow-through money impacts our budget as well. Moving on to the policy option packages, we do have two policy option packages that we're requesting this biennium. One for customer service, that's POP 101, and then also one for investigations or the professional practice, POP 102. Policy option package 101 would increase the FTE from 9.25 to 11.5 in licensure programs. It would also add two FTE for limited duration public service representatives at the PSR4 position. It would reclass three PSR3s to PSR4s so that we would not have the turnover. We train someone, great person, was there for 2.5 weeks. It's a limited duration position, took another position in another state agency at a higher class, making more money. So the PSR4 is really what we're looking for, that reclass. It would add one FTE principal executive manager, licensure director, and then one FTE information services specialist. That's the technology person to actually do the web development. And the source for that is, of course, our licensure, and we have to put fingerprint fees, even though we don't make any money off of that. So major budget information for policy package 101. Again, it's to improve the customer service, the phones and the email. If we could go to where we could answer, leave voicemails and get back to those, I would love to implement that. Currently, I just don't have the capacity to do so. But by maintaining the staff, and once we get things under control a little bit better and we move to the electronic system and there aren't the volume of calls coming in, then we can really get into focusing more on other services, such as implementing even, you know, the voicemail. The production oversight, the second purpose of this package is to restore that full-time executive service management staff member for the licensure production oversight. So what happened was that position was eliminated two biennia ago, and so that director was doing two roles. When I came into the agency, I did some very quick internal assessment and designated the professional practice to my deputy director so that could really be a focus and get that streamlined, and I'm very, very pleased with that. So this would actually allow me to have a licensure director as well as a program approval director. So that would be the difference. So if I see some puzzled faces, it actually reinstates a position authority that we did not have, so that we could not have a split role for my director and actually have one director for licensure, one for program approval, and then the deputy maintain the other two areas. And then to improve software and database integration, and that is to allow that programmer to work with our existing ISS position, to work with NIC USA, our state vendor for the online licensure system, as well as the chief ed office with the statewide longitudinal data system, so that we can get some really quality data. That is a gap that we have currently, and I would love to be able to give you more current information on statistics of, for example, the question yesterday regarding the charter school teachers. I need to have someone who can write scripts so that we can pull these data sets together and have that readily available so we can make informed data-based decisions. Policy option package 102 is the investigations. And again, that would increase the staffing from 5.75 FTE to 8.5 FTE. It would add the one FTE investigator to limited duration, which really would maintain the position that we have, and then add the 0.5 position for the office assistant too. And again, that would just maintain the position that we have, and then reclass two FTE office specialist twos to admin specialist twos. And then the big, big ask is for a case management system. So when you want to know how long it takes from beginning to end, it's not an Excel spreadsheet that we're manually entering into. We can really look at the system going into, here's the case started, and then the system providing us all of those detailed reports so that you can see and we can see where the holdups are and how we can adjust those accordingly. And again, it's our licensure revenue fee that would be paying for those. The case management system, I'd like to talk a little more about that. It would allow us to really monitor those cases. So one of the things from the audit was that we need to implement a case management system so that we can determine where the backlog problems lie and formulate plans to, you know, prevent that and to accelerate that, the cases, the investigation length, and improve the investigation length. This is the solution. Right now, it is very manual, it's very cumbersome, and we don't have good quality data. And it's frustrating. It's frustrating for me, it's frustrating for my deputy, it's frustrating for my team, because we can't really tell you our story if we don't have the data input system to actually give you outputs for that.
Excuse me, Dr. Bean. Mm-hmm. Do you have a case management system either in mind that other agencies use that you've used in other states? Do you have that kind of, do you have something, or is this going to be something that we'll have to create?
Co-Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, thank you for the question. So it would be a hybrid. We would want something that would work. We do have a quote that was provided by NICU USA prior to my arrival to the state. Because it's something that has to be developed. There's not an off-the-shelf product that meets all of our needs because it's very unique. That's what happened with the licensure system. We thought we could purchase something that was utilized in another state. But every state's licensure system is different. In fact, I'm in West Virginia, I use NICU USA, but they couldn't just take what we had in West Virginia and give it to Oregon because it, or likewise from Hawaii to Oregon. It's every law is different in every state with the rules. So same applies to the case management system. Our process is very different than other agencies as well as other states that do the same work that we do. So it's going to be a hybrid. That's where the ISS 6 position can help with the system that we purchase to make those things fit.
Thank you.
And then the other portion of that is to scan the investigative case files. As you know, we're trying to eliminate the storage space that we currently lease in another portion of the great city of Salem. And so we would like to eventually get all of those boxes out of storage and scan into digital imaging so that we no longer have, one, the rent, and two, we have all of our files in one location. So again, just to summarize, our agency organization would increase from 24 FTE to 26 FTE. And then the final closing remarks is that the appendices are located on OLIS. We have the Secretary of State audit response, the emergency board requests, and the summary of the proposed technology projects, as well as the list of reclassifications completed in 2013-15. There were none completed in 15-17. And then our other funds ending balance form. And I would entertain any questions that you have that I have not been able to answer at this point.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, thank you for presentation. Look forward to new leadership in the building. Just a comment first and a question. A comment. Oregon's success with IT systems, creating them, has not been very successful. We have I take your comment about hybrid or off the shelf, but E-Court's been one of the most successful and large systems we've done, and that was off the shelf. Second, if you don't have it today, if you could provide me, what's your success, or how are you helping veterans get licensed in all the different license categories? There was a bill asked, your agency probably reported on that. It's special interest for me, and I know Representative Parrish, so if you could see how you're doing in that, giving veterans a license based upon their past experience, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, Co-Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Wisnett, thank you, one, for the comment, and two, for the question. So There is priority given to veterans when they designate on the application form veteran. That triggers us to let them know we need to look into this one a little deeper. As far as the credit given for prior work, I don't have all of the information about that, but I will look at the OAR and give you that information specifically about what we're doing. And if we have not made those changes, I assure you that we will get that to the Rules Advisory Committee and look into that more closely.
Thank you.
Anybody else before we wanted to ask? Co-Chair Monroe, please.
And once again, I've broached this with you before. Prior to your coming, there was considerable talk, discussion about merging TSPC with the department or making TSPC auxiliary to the department. You've served in situations where the licensure was a part of the department and you're now serving in one where you have a separate agency. Are you comfortable with the current situation, or would you like us to continue to investigate whether or not merging you with the department makes sense?
Co-Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, thank you for the question. That's a great question, and I get that quite frequently, actually, even by other states where I've been identified as someone who's been in both systems. And I have to tell you that first and foremost, being a separate agency is one of the reasons that actually attracted me to this position, because it does allow us to focus on the things that matter, the things that are important to the agency specific, preparation, licensure, and then children, the safety of all students. So by having a commission comprised of 17 practitioners with the membership from the public as well, it's pretty amazing to watch, because the rulemaking process is very, very significantly taken seriously. It's not just one more thing added to an agenda. It is the only area of focus for these 17 commissioners. So that is a component that I think can never be taken too lightly. I would be remiss to say that there are things that I miss about being part of the Department of Education, and one of those is data. But in this state, I don't know that being part of the Department of Education would solve that, because it's a local control state. So even though the data were collected in a statewide system in West Virginia, they're not collected in the same manner here. So those reasons would nullify my reasons for wanting to be part of that larger structure. Again, it's capacity, but it's networking. It's working with other agencies who have similar needs and finding solutions to those situations. So I would prefer to remain exactly where we are and take this to the next level.
Monica, thank you for that answer. Would probably be, if you weren't here, would probably be leading the charge to change the structure. But I'm inclined, because I'm very impressed with you and your leadership, to leave things the way they are and give you an opportunity to show your great success.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Okay, other questions, colleagues, before we move on to the DAS presentation? Thank you very much. Do you want to stay up there while Lise does her presentation? Okay, go ahead.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, again, Lisa Pearson with the Department of Administrative Services, and I will be very, very brief. This slide shows that the agency fits into the seamless system of education priority that was one of the most significant priorities for the governor in putting her budget together. And as you've heard, the issues are essentially licensing and investigation timelines. So this graph on page 3 might address some of the questions that were asked earlier about the time frames for the sweep. If you look at 2009-11, that blue section is the beginning balance, and it was $1.9 million as of that biennium. As of 11-13, it went down to $1.4 million. So it appears to be about a $500,000 or maybe slightly more fund sweep. At the same time, after that, there was the loss of the teacher positions within the school system, and that's where Dr. Bean mentioned that revenue started to decline and not come in nearly as fast as they might have because of that loss of positions and then the unwillingness of people to keep their license up. There is, just to mention real quickly, a general fund amount in 2015-17 that was for the teacher development accreditation program, but that is now other funds.
And excuse me, the 1.5 transfer, is that another sweep or is that a representation of a sweep?
Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, that's actually an interfund transfer, which is a really technical term. An interfund transfer means within a fund. Mm-hmm. So it's a very strange thing, but there was an interfund transfer at that point. And it was before my time, so I can't specifically address what it was for. I know that there were some things going on in terms of some work that was being done with other state agencies, but I suspect it really has more to do with almost in a sort of an accounting kind of approach to things rather than a policy-oriented kind of issue. Real quickly, this agency is mainly personal services supported by services and supplies. The small special payments amount has to do with that accreditation assistance program that was funded in 2015-17. And again, the agency is mainly its general program, which you heard in detail, and then that teacher education program accreditation piece is a very small amount. And then you heard about the investments that were made in the governor's budget. Just to recap, there are adjustments for personnel for improved customer service in Package 101, and then adjustments to personnel to address an increased number of complaints in a timely manner in Package 102. And then, as with every state agency that you will see before you, the statewide adjustments for updates to the DAS price list and state government service charges were made in this agency as well. And you may recall that the Department of Administrative Services and other central government agencies have the same rules in budget development that a line agency such as TSPC has. They can come in agency request budget and ask for anything they feel comfortable asking for. There's, you know, just a threshold of embarrassment kind of criteria. And so DAS and other central agencies will come in and ask for much more than they could ever hope to get. And so in the governor's budget, we ratchet that down. And then by the time you see this budget and other budgets in work session, LFO will have done its good work in ratcheting it down further. So there will be further adjustments at that point, decreasing the amounts that each state agency has to send to DAS or a central agency. And so, in summary, that is a recap of what you just heard in the agency presentation.
Thank you. Any other questions from the DAS analysts? Okay, I would just like to point out that there are a few, while we didn't have any public testimony on site, there are two pieces of public testimony in OLIS, one from an individual regarding dual language immersion and increased pathways for certifying those teachers, and another from the Oregon School Boards Association in support of the work that Dr. Bean has done at TSPC. So I just wanted to point those out while we are still in the hearing. So if there's not anything else, thank you. I will close the hearing on Senate Bill or House Bill 5038, and thank you, everyone. Okay, we have about 20 minutes that we can get a good, solid start on our expected 11 or 12 days of testimony on the Oregon Department of Education and the State School Fund. So I would like to go ahead and open up a hearing on both Senate Bill 5516 and Senate Bill 5517, the Oregon Department of Education budget bill and the State School Funding budget bill, and call up Dr. Salam Noor and Rick Krager as well, the Assistant Superintendent for Finance Administration. And Lisa Pearson will stay up here with us. And Doug, do you want to start us off, please?
Madam Chair, there are our write-ups out on the thing. I'm not going to go through them. Keep in mind, we're going to be simultaneously hearing these two bills because they are related. Both, you'll see a presentation a couple days in on the State School Fund by ODE, both the mechanics of it and sort of the outcomes of it and how the money is distributed. And the rest of the time, we'll be dealing with the department's budget. Please keep in mind this department really has a K-12 focus, an early learning focus, and the youth development division focus. So there are three focuses in here. You'll see Mr. Mandel for early learning, Ms. Bell for the youth development, and Salam and various staff of him for the K-12 and the overall agency budgets. Public testimony will be later at the end or toward the end of the department's presentation. Once we get a few days in how we're rolling, we'll set the date so we can get those out on the public. There'll be a day for sure on State School Fund and K-12 generally, and another day probably jointly on ELD, Early Learning, and Youth Development Division. And I think I'll just stop there.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Welcome.
Good morning, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Salam Noor, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction with the Oregon Department of Education, and I'm joined today with Rick Krager, our Assistant Superintendent of Finance and Administration. We greatly appreciate the opportunity to present our budget to the committee over the course of the next 9 to 11 days, from what I understand. And we're excited to share with you the work that we do as an agency to serve children, students, and families from birth to age 24. We have 2 days dedicated to public testimony. Our presentation, especially today and tomorrow, if you will focus on an overview of the agency budget. And over the course of the next 9 days, you will have an opportunity to hear directly from our colleagues who provide leadership and management to a wide range of programs and services that we provide to students and to families in the state of Oregon. Just to give you a quick outline of what we have planned for the next 9 days, we will start with the overview today and tomorrow. Most likely, we will be followed by a presentation on the Early Learning Division by David Mandel, our Early Learning Division Director, that will share with you the services and programs that are administered through that program under the direction of the Early Learning Council. That will be followed by a 2-day presentation on the State School Funds and all of the technical aspects involved with that and the Common State and the Common School Fund. We will follow that with a presentation about the programs and services that are offered through the department by our various offices, and then we will conclude the ODE aspect of that with a presentation on our budget and operations, followed by a presentation by Iris Bell, our Youth Development Division Director, to describe the work that the division does under the direction and leadership of the Youth Development Council. And that will be followed by public testimony. So we have a lot of information to share with you. We appreciate the opportunity, and we look forward to answering questions and providing you any additional information that you would like. Without getting into a lot of the details relative to the history and structure of the agency, you'll have an opportunity to hear more about that as we get into the program areas. We want to provide a high-level overview of the entire agency and its budget. This provides some background and history on the agency, its charge, and particularly over the last 4 years. Specifically, I want to point out that both the Early Learning Division and the Youth Development Division were established into the Department of Education in the 13-15 biennium. Both of these divisions are part of the agency framework, the overall framework for supports and services. So as we provide the overview today, we will include some of the work that these divisions, these two specific divisions, do. However, you will have an opportunity to hear directly from the directors and learn more about their council, their missions, budget challenges, initiatives, and priorities. from a budget perspective, this slide clearly delineates the current budget. This is a summary of our 17-19 current service level budget. During the course of our presentation, our agency staff will be presenting our budget in terms of current service level, recognizing that we do have a shortfall, and the committee and the legislature have at their discretion the opportunity to address that in any way they deem appropriate. But our presentation will focus on current service level, and I want to be respectful of the fact that you are managing a big shortfall. So in this slide, you will see the level of funding and staffing that we have in the early learning division, in the education services component of for K-12 as part of the agency, and the youth development division. As you will see, our budget has grown by 6.5% from the 2015-17 LAB. The majority of this increase is related to the state school fund. Our total FTE has decreased by 10.10%. Staff members. Rick Crager will provide you some additional information and specifics about this budget later today, and of course towards the end of our overall presentation when we talk about operations. So our governing structure consists of boards and councils, if you will. The state law has created three separate entities, the State Board of Education and two councils. One governs the Early Learning Division and one governs the Youth Development Divisions, hence the Early Learning Council and the Youth Development Council. But together, these three entities govern the work of the Department of Education. The State Board of Education includes seven voting members and two ex officio members representing the Secretary of State's office and the Treasurer's office. The board also has an administrative advisor representing superintendents and administrators around the state. They have a teacher advisor representing teachers and classroom staff around the state. And just recently, the board added two student advisors because we value that perspective and the insight that they bring to their conversation. So the State Board of Education is a longstanding governing body designed to establish and direct the administration and operation of public elementary and secondary schools, and that includes education service districts. And the Early Learning Council has 19 members and by law directs and guides the work of the Early Learning Division. Similarly, the Youth Development Council is a 23-member council and again by law directs and guides the work of the Youth Development Division. As part of our agency overview, we want to share with you the mission and the purpose of each one of these segments of the agency, if you will. Because of the work of ELD and YDD has a narrower focus around specific age groups and programs, each division, in coordination with their independent councils and boards, have a specific mission and purpose. This slide provides each of their mission along with the established mission of the Oregon Department of Education. While each is different, collectively there is a common thread in each mission in helping children, youth, and students and families to be successful, and focuses on learning and lifelong development. Our next slide gives you an overview of our organizational structure, and it shows the relationship amongst the divisions and the core functions within the Department of Education serving K-12. It shows the relationship to the governor, and as I indicated in my comments in the previous slide, you will see that each component of the agency, and we have them color-coded, ELD, YDD, and K-12, the overall FTE is 510.8 staff members, but we just wanted to show you how the organizational structure defines the relationships amongst the entities, and it also provides an opportunity for working across these different divisions and these different segments. As we look at the delivery and services that the agency provide, we have a fairly extensive portfolio that is delivered and coordinated through the different parts of the agency, Early Learning Division, K-12, Youth Development Division. All together, we work to fulfill the pledge to all The governor's commitment and pledge to all Oregon's children and families to build a seamless system of education and support from cradle to career. So we all embrace and support the governor's vision towards that goal. We work with a variety of stakeholders to accomplish that goal, and those are education partners, nonprofits, community-based organizations, communities of colors, early learning hubs, and many others that we partner with on a regular basis to help do this work and to help deliver it in a manner that is meaningful and, I want to say, customized to the communities that we wish to engage in and serve. So as we model this goal of a seamless system of education and support from cradle to career, the establishment of ELD and YDD into the Oregon Department of Education, it allows us to focus those services into a continuum and to look for opportunities to coordinate and collaborate. Just some examples of the services provided by each one of those segments. So the Early Childhood Services Program, we have the preschool opportunities, the preschool education opportunities that serves children from ages 4 to 5. We have quality child care services through the Office of Child Care. On the K-12 side, it's really servicing and operating the state school fund. We work on the development and implementation of core academic standards in all subject areas that students must demonstrate that they know and be able to do in order to be successful. Our work on the achievement gap and closing opportunity gaps for historically underserved population, and the services provided by the Youth Development Division around interventions and at-risk youth. Okay. I think this chart really has a much better way of showing the continuum of services relative to specific age groups and the overlap and the opportunities for coordination and collaboration across all of us in order to ensure that services are provided in the most effective, efficient, streamlined, and quality manner. So this represents, again, it's color-coded, and it just represents the opportunities for us. So for example, we have collaboration with the early special education services with early learning division programs that helps increase outreach to help identify more eligible children and better assessments relative to their social, emotional, and health and educational needs. The full implementation of full-day kindergarten was done in coordination with the early learning division. Having them be part of the department helped inform our thinking, helped inform the need of teachers that are serving students at a much earlier age for a long period of time, and the resources that are required to make sure that they are better prepared as they enter our system. And when we look at out-of-school youth, the work with the Youth Development Division helps us identify opportunities for youth re-engagement and coordinate services and supports for that. So again, you'll have an opportunity to hear directly from David Mendel relative to the summary, the delivery of services provided by the Early Learning Division. But these are just some examples, which is the administration of the early learning and development programs throughout the state, supporting the early learning hubs, regulation of licensed child care facilities to administer the Federal Child Care and Development Fund. I will try to get through these as quickly as I can because you'll have an opportunity to get more detailed information on them. So, as we look at the services that are provided for K-12 public education segment, if you will, we have a wide range of services, and we have organized the agency in a way to help deliver these services to schools and districts that they expect from us and rely on us for to support student learning and achievement. One of those, of course, is the implementation of the state school fund, and there is a tremendous amount of work that goes into that. And our goal is to make sure that it's a seamless process, it's an easy process, and gets resources to schools and districts to support students. The other is the state school facility grant, and you'll have an opportunity to hear about that from Rick. He and his team has led the development and implementation of that program, and it's proving to be greatly welcomed by local schools and districts and communities, and contributing in more ways than we could have imagined. part of the services that we provide is really is focused on teaching and learning. Assessment is part of that, but the emphasis is on teaching and learning and supporting teachers and educators in their work with students every day, focusing on classrooms and what needs to happen in classrooms to support our diverse and growing student population in our state. So one of the key things that we do is the development of the academic content standards, and we do that with teachers. We convene teachers in what we call content and assessment panels to look at what we expect students at every grade level in every subject area, not just in math and reading. We have it in science and social studies and the arts and health and PE to determine what should we expect students to know and be able to do at every grade level. We also administer the statewide assessment that's specifically tied to reading, math, and science, and that is both a federal and a state requirement. So we have a lot of work to do in that area, and we also do it in conjunction with teachers and stakeholders. I talked a little bit about the state school fund, but the amount is significant. We manage a large portion of the state fund, if you will, to support schools and districts in the state, 197 schools and 19 education service districts. We operate a school. The Department of Education has a school, and it's a school for the deaf. And I love the fact that we operate a school because it keeps us grounded, it keeps us tied to what's happening relative to kids and families, and we're proud of their accomplishments, and you'll have an opportunity to hear about them and the work that they do when Sarah Drinkwater, Assistant Superintendent for Student Services, shares that information with you. We provide a lot of services covering a range of opportunities for students with disabilities, students whose English is other than English. We have a lot of supports around closing the achievement gap through our English language learner programs, our African American Black Student Success Plan, the work that we do with our native students. So we have a lot of programs that we'll have an opportunity to share with you in more detail that really get at the core function of the agency. And that includes a lot of grants that we manage as well. So, 13. Mm-hmm. The Youth Development Division provides critical services to students that are in school and out of school youth. Some of those are re-engagement to bring them back into school, but provide services for them to obtain the credentials, the certificates, or even high school diploma that will help them successful as they consider other options and opportunities. Again, you'll have an opportunity to hear directly from Iris Bell, our Youth Development Division Director, and she'll expand more on some of the services that you have listed here on the screen. So we've talked about the division and provided you a summary of the services, and I want to underscore a summary because we have a lot of programs that we service and manage on a regular basis. But these are the communities that we serve. We have 230,000 children under the age of five, 4,420 licensed child care facilities, 576,407 students in K-12 that attend 197 school districts in 1,239 schools, and they are taught by highly talented educators, approximately 78,000 of them, that are teachers, administrators, support staff professionals, business office professionals, that total up to 66,000 FTE that's based on our 2015-16 school year. We have 17,127 youth ages 6-24 that access services through programs that we provide. And we do this work, as I mentioned earlier, through collaboration, coordination, communication, and partnering with a variety of stakeholders that work directly in these schools and communities, and some work at a state level. And we feel fortunate to have them as part of our process because that makes our work a lot more relevant, it makes it meaningful, it makes it specific to the students and the groups that we're trying to serve and impact. Okay. So this represents our K-12 students at a glance. You'll hear more about the early learning segment students and the youth development division, youth development students from the respective directors. But this really represents our students at the K-12 level. And just a couple of things to highlight, and one is the growing diversity of our student population in the state of Oregon. Over 36% of our students are non-white, and they have different cultural, ethnic, social backgrounds, And that means we have to be responsive to their needs. We have to provide services in a different way that helps meet their needs and the needs of their students. 10% of our student population is English learners, and 13% receive special education services. So with each of these different types of students, there is required different educational opportunities, approaches in which the department and its partners implements in order to ensure that all of those students are successful. The indicators to the right show that while there's still a lot of work to do, the trends for graduation and dropout are actually moving in the right direction. So high school graduation has increased by 61.1 percentage points since 2012, and our dropout rate has held steady. We would like to see a zero dropout rate, and we would like to see that graduation rate continue to trend upwards. And we are making, we are taking some steps, and we can talk more about those once we get into the programmatic areas to help influence that and move it in an upward direction. Okay. Want us to continue?
Major changes, yep. And then pause. How about if we get through the couple pages on major agency changes over the last triennia, and then we'll
absolutely
for the day. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you wanted us to share with you some of the significant changes that have had an impact on the agency and its and the way it operates. So as we focus the work on addressing the needs of our customers. We have had to navigate a variety of changes over the last 6 years in particular that have shaped the work and the approach of the department. These two slides in particular provide you with a summary of some of the major changes that also affected our budget request. So they impacted the way we operate as an agency, impacted the work that we do, hence impacted the budget request. So particular areas of interest was the 40-40-20 goal that really put into motion a lot of programmatic changes and strategic investments on the part of the state to actually help students achieve that goal. For example, the full-day kindergarten. It's something that we believe is based on a principle of equity to provide access to full-day kindergarten in some places where students and families were not able to afford that, pay for it, or access it. But that's also driven by our 40-40-20 goal to improve graduation rates and graduation outcomes, and specifically with our historically underserved students. So the full-day kindergarten was affected by our 40-40-20 goal, and that increased the investment that was needed in our schools. That investment is having a huge positive impact because we know now that 49,000 kids attended full-day kindergarten in 15-17, and that's an increase in the number of kids. We've seen some investments in CTE and STEM based on our desire to increase engagement in our schools and to link career pathways with education that's happening in classrooms in a variety of subject areas. And that required an investment of funding in CTE and STEM. The investments that were done, that were made in 13-15 continue to be more streamlined and aligned, if you will. Slide my 17. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So all of these bills have really contributed to some investments that have been reflected in our budget. So we've seen an increased investment in early childhood programs. We've seen, as I said, increased investments in STEM and CTE funding. We've seen increased funding for educator effectiveness and school improvement, and we've seen grants in a variety of targeted areas to student success in the classroom and beyond. Some of those I will discuss shortly relative to House Bill 2016, House Bill 3499, and others. So. Okay. Measure 98 is something that has occurred in the 15-17 biennium. It will be implemented in the 17-19 biennium. So that had a budget impact on us that you see reflected in our budget. House Bill 3499 was an investment that was designed specifically to improve outcomes for early learning, for English language learners, and we're folding that into a statewide plan for English learners. That was an investment that was targeted to closing opportunity gaps and improving the achievement gap for our English learners. The Every Student Succeeds Act is a federal mandate but it also has an impact on the way we operate as an agency. It has an impact on schools and districts, and we believe it has budget implications that have been reflected in our budget. We'll provide you some additional details relative to all of those components once we get into the office presentations and the programmatic aspects of this. So. House Bill 2016, the African American Student Success Bill, was also a key legislation that provided investments for improving outcomes for African American students. And we have an opportunity as a state to dig deep into that work and to get really specific about the strategies and the approaches that we need to take in order to improve outcomes for our African American black students. Key legislation was passed to begin addressing the capital needs of Oregon schools. The state was able to provide incentive funding, a state match that better positioned school districts in passing local bonds designated to meet their school capital needs. So in 15-17, and we're not done with that biennium yet, the state has issued and will issue up to $126.2 million of general obligation fund bonds that is helping to leverage additional local funds that will enable the state to invest $2.6 billion in capital construction for an estimated 31 school districts around the state. Based on current economic multipliers, this investment is estimated to create over $3.7 billion of statewide economic activity. And Rick Crager, our Assistant Superintendent for Finance and Administration, has led that effort and has done a phenomenal job. And he'll share more with you about the impact of that program as we continue. So of the 23 school districts that have already received grant awards, 15 are small and rural districts and communities. These awards will result in 105 projects, of which 41 are targeted for safety, security, and seismic upgrades. So, all right. Want us to stop here?
Let's. Yeah, I think we pause. Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question has to do with smarter balance. Are we renewing that this year, or is this the year in which we have to do that? It was my understanding it's coming close.
Yes.
And number two, ESSA, combined with that, has given us some more options with respect to statewide testing. So are we looking at that with regard to how much we pay for smarter balance, and are there ways to make it less if we're going to go with other options and those kinds of things?
Right. Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Senator Roblin, thank you very much for the question, and I promise you we'll have an opportunity to get into more details.
I know. I just want to make sure I think it is this year.
Level, and I really appreciate the question, and I was hoping to have an opportunity to talk about it. So on SBAC, what we have actually two aspects to our relationship with the vendors that we work with. With the SBAC consortium, and that is the consortium of states that's responsible for collecting items and providing those items for testing, we have what's called an MOU. A memorandum of understanding. That MOU is a three-year MOU. We're reaching the end of the third year of MOU, and our plan is to not continue the MOU for 3 years, perhaps to do it on an annual basis and continue to examine our relationship with SBAC and to continue to measure the benefits that we receive from that relationship. What I will tell you is that SBAC is the only entity that has items that we can access now for testing. Relative to ESSA, ESSA provides us opportunities that may affect our relationship with SBAC
right.
and other testing providers. So ESSA gives us the option to consider other assessments at the high school level that are nationally norm reference assessments, such as SAT, ACT, and perhaps there are others out there. So we are taking advantage of that flexibility, and we're in the process of issuing an RFI, a request for information from vendors to tell us if that assessment meets the requirements in ESSA. And the requirements basically is that they have to be aligned to the academic content standards that we have as a state, and they have to meet all of the accommodation requirements, such as access, testing for our students that are hearing impaired or visually impaired, and special needs accommodations. And that's why we have a relationship with SBAC, because those items do that. The other part of the contract is with the testing delivery company, so to speak, and that's AIR, the American Institute of Research. They take those items, they listen to what we want based on what teachers have told us, and then they develop the testing engine, which is computerized, that's delivered to students around the state. So we're looking at all of those pieces. We are going to take advantage of every ounce of flexibility provided to us by ESSA, and we're going to do what's best for the state of Oregon. Whether it's going to cost less or not,
right,
I can't I tell you.
Right.
As we explore options such as SAT and ACT, we really don't know the cost for those assessments. Some people think that it will be the same cost that students pay now to take those tests. That's actually not accurate, simply because all of these other accommodations have to be considered as part of the test, and that typically increases the cost. However, I'll commit to you that we're going to explore all of those options. If there are some efficiencies that we can achieve, we are more than happy to do that. Our goal is to deliver a well-rounded education, a balanced assessment system that includes formative and interim assessments in addition to these summative assessments. Our goal is to reduce the footprint of the summative assessment so it's not taken 3, 4, and 5 hours for a student to complete the test. So we're looking at this very critically, we're looking at it very holistically, and we're exploring all options that are available to us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we're going to stop there, and we'll pick up tomorrow with environmental factors and then moving forward into this budget proposal for the biennium. So
okay. Thank you very much.
With that, I would like to close the hearing on Senate Bills 5516 and Senate Bill 5517, and we are adjourned for today.